AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show for your Friday. We're not here today. Brand new to you content, though. We love doing this. Interviews that we've not aired before that you will get to hear. First up, coming up in just a little bit, it's Doug Hoverson. He's got a book out, The Drink That Made Wisconsin Famous, Beer and Brewing in the Badger State. We'll talk to him about his book and the history of beer in Wisconsin. Then a fantastic conversation with Star Tribune columnist Kurt Brown. He writes their history article in the Sunday papers. He's got a book out, Minnesota 1918, When Flu, Fire, and War Ravaged the State. A phenomenal conversation with him as well. Stay with us this entire hour. We've got a lot to get to right here on AM 950. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show, 952-946-6205. Doug Hoverson is the author of The Drink That Made Wisconsin Famous, Beer and Brewing in the Badger State, a brand new book out for him, and he's kind enough to hear today to talk about the history of brewing in Wisconsin and the current state of the brewing industry over there. Hi, Doug, how are you?
Pretty good. Thanks for inviting me on your show.
My absolute pleasure. First of all, how'd you get interested? I mean, obviously a lot of people like beer, but not many people would be getting to the point where they're writing a book about it. How'd you get so interested in this topic specifically?
Well, I'm going to claim that I came to it from the history side, and I'm going to stick with that story.
Okay.
For a while, it seemed like every time I went on vacation, I'd see some old building in a downtown area, and it would turn out to be an old brewery. And some of my other research, I came up with things about old breweries. And eventually, I said to a few friends, maybe I'll write a book about brewing in Minnesota. And then they kept asking me how the book was coming along, and I was kind of stuck with it.
Well, it's an interesting element of Wisconsin history, of American history, the brewing industry. I mean, We talk about the farmers. We'll talk about, you know, an industry like the milling industry in Minneapolis, where it was growing and it was unique to the area. And I think that there's a tendency people forget that, you know, a lot of places had a brewery, but when they started becoming successful, like they had quite a bit of success in Wisconsin, that was really a unique thing. And so brewing became iconic with Wisconsin.
Yeah, it really did. And I think it was a combination of having really good natural resources, from the grain being right there to the water, but also some really talented brewers and some really talented publicists. Fred Pabst got his name out there all the time. So did Val Blatz. The Millers did later. So they combined kind of an agricultural industrial excellence with really realizing where modern marketing was going and combine those two to make themselves worldwide names.
Was it a lot of this have to do with, I mean, there's a lot when it comes to the growth of America with the European settlers. One of the things that's really common is that certain groups came over in large mass at certain times. Is that really a lot what happened here, that the Germans and the countries that brewing was a big part of their national culture, they came over, and to have a little bit of that home, they started it here?
That's especially true in Wisconsin as well as Iowa and Minnesota. When those territories were really opening up to settlement, that was when the big exodus of Germans was happening in the 1840s. And the Germans in particular came over with enough money to start their own businesses, and often came over with some skills. And a lot of times that skill was brewing. So like a lot of modern immigrants will come over and do the business that they did back home. That's what the Germans did, and they made some great beer.
You talk about going into old towns and going to the old town, and you'd realize one of the earliest buildings there would be a brewery. Was it pretty common that when a town started to establish itself, within, you know, one of the first few businesses to start up would be a brewery?
It depended on where it was, but that was often the case, especially if it was a town not particularly near another brewery. In the case of Madison, it wasn't one of the first businesses, but they got to it pretty quickly because it was getting kind of tough to send all the way to either Milwaukee or Monroe to get beer there. So it was something that once you had that critical mass of population, it was going to be a really essential part of the agribusiness.
Milwaukee itself was an epicenter, and I still think that historically, I mean, I know St. Louis likes to put their name out there, but pound for pound, you can't really beat Milwaukee. I mean, they had the biggest names in beer for many years.
Yeah, they did, and that really goes back to about the 1870s when Pabst and Schlitz really got going and started to make their move nationally. There's some old stories that they really got their advantage when they shipped beer to Chicago after the Chicago fire, but they'd been shipping there beforehand. It helped they were on the lakes, it helped they were near rail traffic, and it also helped that Milwaukee itself wasn't that huge, so they had a lot of beer to export. New York made a lot more beer, but they drank it all there.
That's good. Well, and it's also in merging into a marketing thing. I mean, you talk about the fact that these were localized beers. I mean, there was that change in post-Civil War America where the people that kind of understood early marketing and early product distribution, that's when the larger companies started coming about. And it just seems as if the Milwaukee breweries, the Wisconsin breweries, just did a much better job of marketing the product.
Well, they did, because a couple of things happened at the same time. You got the railroad network developing in all directions, so that linked Milwaukee in. You had the improved communications, so they could get the word out about their beers, and you had the beginning of readily available bottled beer, which made it much easier to ship. So now, all of a sudden, people in California or Louisiana can actually demand their local retailers get them Schlitz beer, Pabst beer, and then they can go ahead and make that happen, and they really capitalized on that.
Well, and I guess one of the questions I have for you with that is, it's interesting, Guinness is the great Irish beer, and of course, if it's a stout, but I mean, if you get further away from Dublin, the worse it tastes. Was there, it seems like they had the ability that the flavor that you would get in a Phoenix with one of their beers was pretty much the same beer it was going to be there. Was there something special about that, or just was it a case where it just traveled better?
Well, I think part of it was the fact that the brewmasters did a really great job coming up with a stable beer. And so the beer they were shipping out, at least in that 1870s, 80s, 90s period, was usually called their export beer.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that they did to make it a little bit more stable was added some corn to it. So it created a lighter beer, but also one that would ship better. So you really were, if you were buying the export beer in Madison, it would taste pretty much like it would in Nebraska or Kansas, because the brewmasters did such a great job of creating a clean product.
Well, and that is such an important element of consistency. I mean, just ask McDonald's. I mean, when they became a major franchise, is that if you can maintain that consistency and keeping the control, I imagine there wasn't like it is today where there are breweries around. A lot of larger companies have breweries in other places too. They pretty much brewed all their beer in Wisconsin, right?
Yeah, especially in the early days. You really don't have those multiple plant breweries until after Prohibition, with the exception of Miller that tried to start one in Bismarck, North Dakota in the 1880s. Their water was totally different. It was a financial disaster. So they really were dependent on that idea that we're going to have the water, and that was going to provide consistency. And the best brewmasters were usually the best paid employees in the entire company, because if you lose your brewmaster, you're probably going to lose your quality.
Doug Hoverson joining us right now. We're talking about his latest book, The Drink That Made Wisconsin Famous, Beer and Brewing in the Badger State, a Bismarck beer. Okay, I mean, I'm no master of all this stuff, but I think I know where you're... You went to Bismarck, for goodness sakes. I know that it was probably a little more of a fight in town back then, but that is such a key to this. You know, the water you have in Wisconsin, even the air that is, you know, around the hops and the barley, I mean, it's different, and if you don't have that product control, I think it's the case. I mean, was there ever a concern by these guys that once they started becoming more and more popular that they'd be able to produce enough beer to go around the country like they did?
Well, I think they were pretty confident in the way they could actually brew it. But I think one of the things that you see in the advertising going from, say, the 1860s or 70s going to closer to the turn of the 1900s was that idea of process and consistency, and you saw a lot less talk about we got our hops from the Hallertau region of Germany, or we get all of our barley from Ontario or something like that. It was really talking about how efficient their factory was and how pure the air was and how all of the fermenters were vacuum sealed, and really going with that whole idea that this is a pure product created by a pure process rather than a really distinctive one.
Of course, the industry is going great. We get into the early part of the 1900s and it hits a wall. Prohibition comes on through, and I don't think there's a state that got hit harder by this than Wisconsin there. When that came down to light, I imagine there was a lot of people panicking.
Well, there were, and Wisconsin, like Minnesota and some of the other upper Midwest states, was kind of a study in contrasts, because the progressive politicians of the area in many cases saw prohibition as a way to help out the working class and save them from drunkenness. So Wisconsin actually had a pretty strong vote for prohibition if you weren't German, because clearly they were going to lose their property values, their livelihoods, and their names wouldn't have the same reputation as they had previously.
During that time, though, the industry somewhat adapted. Is that a fair way to say it?
Yeah, they did. They made a number of other products which would at least keep the lights on. Some of them made some near beers so they could hang on to their brewmaster. And one of the buildings at Pabst was actually converted into a lock factory, which sold a lot of locks to the federal government that were used to padlock the saloons they had raided. So there was a lot of creative adaption. And, of course, some of them kept on making beer if they were in some of the small towns and sent it out by whatever ways they could.
The list of names that came out of Wisconsin, I mean, they're pound for pound, I mean, industry-wise, and outside of maybe auto industry in Michigan, you don't have, I mean, Miller and Pabst, Schlitz, you bought Blatzup. The names were, these were just iconic names, especially from when I was growing up before the age of consolidation. These were all just iconic names in the beer industry.
And they really were. And outside of Anheuser-Busch and St. Louis, you really don't have somebody else with that national or even worldwide appeal really anywhere else in the country. And you have so many of them in Milwaukee. And then if you add La Crosse in, you have Heilemann and pre-Prohibition, two other really big names. So you've got this amazing concentration in a middle-sized state and a upper middle-sized city that's really unusual.
Was beer actually bigger than farming and agriculture and Wisconsin cheese at that point, do you think?
Early on, it was bigger than cheese. I really don't think you could say it was bigger than agriculture, because there were just so many crops involved. And overall, beer is a good value-added product, but Wisconsin did have other things.
The age of consolidation in the brewing industry, it's to a point, it's a sad time, because I think, as you mentioned, you know, communities got their identity from their beer. And in this day, all of a sudden it's owned by some guy in Amsterdam or Berlin or something like that. And it's you know, kind of being much more mass produced. It lost a lot of bit of that. Talk a little bit about the age of consolidation, because it really has, to a point, taken a toll on the iconic brands.
Well, it did. And one of the other things, as you mentioned, about beer is so often it's the name of the founding family actually on the product. And yeah, you really don't see that in a lot of other businesses. And Wisconsin's kind of an interesting case, because we had just talked a lot about those really big breweries. Wisconsin didn't have too many mid-sized ones. They went to the really big ones and the really small ones. So you would have breweries like Walter and Eau Claire or Stevens Point that would hang on. And I think one of the biggest reasons they did is because Wisconsin had such a tavern culture. They sold more draft beer as a percentage of the beer sold than any other state in the country. So they had built up that loyalty. If you could go out to the tavern on County Road K and still get the brewery right down the road to bring you that fresh beer.
Yeah, and I think that it's, you know, as it changes up and it became something different, there's just a glossiness that came off the industry.
Well, I think there was, and I think you saw a decreased lack of variety. You saw a decrease of interest in making Bock beer in the spring by a lot of the brewers. And beer moved from being something that was distinctive to something that was pretty much just a price product for most people.
On the other side of this, it does, you know, through change comes, you know, generally, you know, opportunity. And we have seen, and not only in Wisconsin, but nationwide, Minneapolis, St. Paul as well, the rise of the microbreweries. And they really have, you know, taken hold here. It's something that I know in Wisconsin, that every person I know in Wisconsin, they have a smaller brewery beer that is their favorite, and they always talk about it.
Yeah, that's true. And, of course, the ones you hear a lot about are places like New Glarus with their Spotted Cow and Sprecher and some of the other ones. But it's been a great thing. The brewers I've talked to usually have been people who are from that town or their grandparents used to have the cabin in that town, and they really felt a lot of pride there, and they wanted to bring local beer to the area in the same way that they like having local food products and local non-chain restaurants. So it's really bringing that sense of place back to the beer, as well as bringing a lot of variety to the beer styles.
I'm going to give you one good and one bad. I want to get your thoughts on this, on when it comes to microbreweries. On microbreweries, here's a good one. The variety of beer that we have in America sometimes is incredibly bland. Going to Germany, when I was stationed in the military over there, there was just a much larger variety of beers available to you. And you didn't realize all this variety was out there. And I think one of the things that's a benefit of microbreweries, small breweries, is the embracing of draft varieties, which haven't really been popular either for a long time or ever really in America, but they're trying to give them a shot and give them a new platform.
I think you could really describe America as a beer arc in some ways, that we resurrected a lot of those styles that were dead in their homelands even sometimes. And a brewer will look at an old brewing recipe book and try that recipe. So we make more smoked beers in America than we do back in Franconia, where you were for a while. We've done a lot more varieties of stouts than you can find in the British Isles and Ireland. And, you know, while sometimes the variety can go a little bit too far, I think it's really changed people's idea of what beer can be.
Mm-hmm. And I like your comment about sometimes variety goes a little too far. I think one of the things that, to a point, on the negative side of the microbreweries, they try too hard sometimes, and they try to make these, you know, interesting concoctions that they add this flavor, add this flavor. The reality is, when one of the great lessons I think you can learn from the great breweries of Wisconsin is that if you just put out a good, consistent product, it doesn't have to be flashy. It doesn't have to be the flavor of the month. It doesn't have to be anything. I had a Miller High Life that was over at Old Milwaukee County Stadium, and I swear to God, it was one of the top three beers I've ever had in my entire life. It was just plain delicious. And if you don't have to do, you can just do a regular pils. You can just do a regular draft beer, and it can be good. And I think sometimes we forget that.
Well, there's a reason that the Pilsner style sells more beer than any other style in the world. It's not only a great-tasting, clean drink, but it's also a really good indicator of exactly how good a brewer is. If he or she can nail that style, they can make anything. And sometimes that's the right beer for the particular meal. Sometimes it's the right beer for the occasion. Like you said, if you're going to be at County Stadium, a Miller from across the street might just be the beer you need.
Oh, it was. That was, and I had a few that day. That was very tasty. I wish we had something that good here in Minnesota. Doug Hoverson, once again, the drink that made Wisconsin famous, beer and brewing in the Badger State. I do want to mention, coming up here on September 5th, you're going to be at Wooden Hill Brewing, correct?
Yes, that's the official Minnesota kickoff, or book launch. We're going to have an event that evening, and I'll be talking a little bit about the Wisconsin history and its great culture that put together, and we'll give you a chance to drink some of the great beers they're making over there, and you know, hope a bunch of people can come out.
Wooden Hill Brewing, once again, September 5th. I'll make sure we get the details out on that, Doug, as we get a little closer. Thank you so much. This has been a great conversation, and it's a great topic, too, as you talk about history and just, you know, icons in American business. You really can't beat it. It's got a real thick bit of content here. The drink that made Wisconsin famous, beer and brewing in the Badger State, Doug Hoverson. Doug, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Well, you were welcome. I appreciate you inviting me on.
My pleasure. We'll take a break right now. Come on back. It is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show, 952-946-6205. Minnesota, 1918, when flu, fire, and war ravaged the state. Kurt Brown is the author. You might recognize Kurt as a long-writing history writer for the Star Tribune. His book is out right now. He's kind enough to join us to talk about his book. Hi, Kurt. How are you?
I'm doing great, Matt. Thanks for talking with me.
Thanks for being here, and I think your articles in the Star Tribune are exceptional. I really like the one about the Hopkins Raspberry Festival that you did around the 4th of July.
Well, it's really become, we've done it now for 5 years, and it's become kind of a crowdsourcing history thing. The first column we wrote, we put a little, almost as an afterthought at the end. We said, if you have suggestions or ideas for this column, email MinnesotaHistory@StarTribune, and it comes into my Gmail. And I tell my wife that every week I kind of put my hands out, and these little gifts kind of parachute down with people's family stories. And so I'm the lucky guy who gets to spin these tales, but it's really a reader-driven, character-driven project, and I love it.
I'll tell you about my great-uncle Cedric Adams' wedding up in 1929 up in the Iron Range, all right?
Well, that would be great.
I'd love to tell you about that. The 1918, your book, I'm glad we bring up this year because I am really starting to realize it via the Minnesota Historical Society with their World War I exhibit they had, plus reading a little bit on my own. I think 1918 was such an important pivotal year world internationally in the U.S. and in Minnesota. It's a year I think that a lot of people kind of overlook because of World War II, but the reality is this really changed a lot of things going on in the state of Minnesota.
Well, and for me, I was commissioned by the Minnesota Historical Society Press. They wanted to kind of commemorate the 100th anniversary of this year. It was really a trifecta of woe. Not only did you have World War I raging in Europe and taking tens of thousands of Minnesotans into the trenches, but you had the flu pandemic, the deadliest outbreak of a disease in world history. And on top of all that, in October of 1918, you had deadly fires up in the Cloquet Moose Lake area that I think a lot of people don't realize was the number one natural disaster in terms of a death toll of over 450 people dying from the fire. And if you were lucky enough to survive the fire, you were often crammed into evacuee housing where you got the flu and died. So it was truly a trifecta of woe, Matt.
You break the book down. It's interesting. Each one of your chapters kind of has a theme, which is not necessarily like, you know, specifically the war or the flu or the fires. You run basically through the year.
Well, and originally I thought I was going to look for two or three characters that maybe were touched by two or three of these things, the flu, the war, and the fires. And I kind of shifted during the research, because I was getting all kinds of great stuff, County Historical Society, and I kind of put the word out to the network of history buffs in Minnesota. And so I kind of changed to a more of a mosaic approach, where I just took a lot of individual stories that I thought were compelling and kind of stitched those together. So instead of wrapping the narrative around two or three people, I decided to just kind of give a mosaic, and hopefully at the end of the book, readers get a sense of what that year was like in Minnesota.
We'll talk about each one of these kind of individually because they are, you know, on their own, they were such large issues. And World War One is where we'll start off. The United States doesn't enter into the war till late, but at the same time, this was an interesting war. The Spanish-American War, there were the Spanish territories that were, you know, nearby, so there was kind of that feeling of justification, even though it ended up being on a global scale. The Zimmerman Met letter sends the United States on in. Talk a little bit about that, because I mean, when you look at the idea of this, I mean, sending a lot of these people, their families had just come to the United States within the last 40, 50 years, and now they're going back and fighting a war in Europe.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people in Minnesota and around the country think, oh, Minnesota, that's where all the Scandinavians live. But actually, German ancestry is the dominant strain in Minnesota. So at that time in 1918, there were so many kind of newly arrived German immigrants, and all of a sudden we're in a war, a world war, which we'd never been in a foreign war like that before. And so a lot of these kids who were being sent over to the trenches were going to fight the kids of their parents' old neighbors from Westphalia and other parts of Germany. So with New Ulm and places in Minnesota so deeply rooted in German tradition, it was really a quandary for the state.
Well, and I was reading a little bit and watching a little bit about World War One. One of the things I found to be fascinating was really up until even 1916, the Germans were coming on like, you know, goodwill tours to get money and donations and praise. They were coming into the United States and being greeted by the German ancestors that were here as heroes, that it wasn't really until later that the decision was made. But still, it was not an easy choice for the German Americans that were here, because this was the feeling of, and granted, I mean, Europe every once in a while, every 20, 30 years was blowing up into a war, you know, and so there is still, you know, there's long simmering feuds that were there. All of a sudden, you're fighting under a completely different flag against your own country. That was not something that I think that went over too well at all.
No, and then in towns like I mentioned, New Ulm, which was deeply, of course, there's Hermann the German, a big statue in New Ulm in southern Minnesota. So the, you know, the mayor and the leaders of the community were all very strong and had recently visited German. Some of the doctors had been over there and studying with German scientists. And so there was all kinds of connections. So all of a sudden you were asked, are you a patriot to America? And of course they have a love and an oath for their new country, but they still have relatives and family and history in Germany. So, like I said, it was quite a dilemma for a lot of these people. And it became kind of an anti-immigrant. You know, a lot of the themes in my book you see playing out today as well, mm-hmm. with flu deaths, you know, high, and soldiers fighting in far-off wars, and forest fires are worse than ever. But that whole anti-immigrant sentiment now that is kind of ripping the country apart was certainly at play, although 1918, it was the German and the Germans who were being considered the disloyal, and maybe they were spies for the enemy, and so there was a lot of paranoia in that department.
Well, and exactly, you say the mimicking of the modern times, the battle lines had been drawn, us versus them. And I think by the time we got to the end of 1918 and the end of World War One, America itself had changed in that it was no longer, once you come here, you're under the red, white, and blue. And there was still some carryover into World War II, a little bit of that. But for the most part, I think there was this idea of, you know, we are our own country, we're our own identity. But it was the growing pains and that war that basically finally pushed the United States into that. We're no longer a bunch of immigrants. We are our own country. And I think Teddy Roosevelt earlier, like I said, the Spanish-American War, was able to kind of solidify it to a point. But I really feel as if when we got to the end of World War One, that's really what the mantle of America became.
Yeah, I've heard the metaphor before. A lot of people have heard about the melting pot, and we mm-hmm. became this, you know, a bunch of different ethnic backgrounds have come together and melted together as one, when really, I think in some ways it's more of a salad where you have a bunch of stuff in the same bowl, but it all, some's crunchy and some is different. Maybe I'm torturing the analogy, but somewhere between the melting bowl and the salad bowl, we found ourselves in 1918.
I like your analogy. Good salad, soup and salad. There's nothing wrong with that. The flu obviously was another problem. I've read actually about Philadelphia's issues they had with the flu. I read a great book about 20 years ago about that, and I never knew the flu was this bad. Yeah, same thing. You know, soldiers, primarily soldiers coming back from World War I, bringing with them a European strain, this flu, which in Philadelphia at the time wiped out a large portion of their population. This was really an incredible disease issue that we just kind of have forgotten about.
And really, without World War I, we don't have this big pandemic, because the misnomer is, a lot of people call it the Spanish flu, and that's rooted in the fact that the U.S. and British governments both had kind of censorship laws going on, and you weren't allowed in the media to report on anything that might hurt the war effort. So you see a lot of the old newspaper clips I found in my research. The county health directors or medical leaders would say, well, there's a flu and a couple people have died, but we'll have this thing under control. Don't worry about it. They kind of course, downplayed it, not to hurt the war spirit. Spain was not really involved in World War I, so when tens of thousands of Spaniards started dying, all of a sudden it became known as the Spanish flu. But the flu really started in Kansas, they think. There's a lot of different theories, but the leading theory is it was a farm kid in Kansas who probably contracted this deadly strain of influenza from a pig. Then he went off to train for World War I in a crowded camp where suddenly dozens of his fellow soldiers got the flu. And as these troops were moved all around the place and transported to Europe and back and all around, that flu spread, and 50 million people, they estimate worldwide, ended up dying of the flu.
Well, and your book touches on some of the numbers here. The 196,000 U.S. citizens died from the flu in October while fires were going on, as you mentioned earlier as well. And then you basically, of the 1.8 billion people on the planet in 1918, nearly one-fourth of its population, estimated 7.5 billion. According to the Science Journal, about 1 in 5 people globally came down with the flu in 1918. 28% of Americans. Do you know the number? How many Minnesotans died in Minnesota from the flu?
Well, the best estimate is about 12,000. And if you think about that, today the state is three times bigger than it was in 1918. So I mean, it would be just a huge number of people dying in a matter of months. Really, like I said, like you mentioned, October was kind of the peak for all these things: the fires in northern Minnesota, the flu. Came in about three different waves, and I don't know if a lot of people realize, but more soldiers died of the flu than in the battlefields. Minnesotans sent 118,000 people into World War I, and 1,400 died on the battlefields, killed in action, but almost twice as many, 2,300, died of the flu. So you find that a lot of times, even back in the Civil War, disease is often the number one killer, more than the bullets and the tanks and the cannonballs.
And what was it's interesting, as a person who is a veteran, I'm a veteran, I was U.S. Army, they still teach those lessons they learned from World War I today, whereas in the Civil War, they kind of shrugged their shoulders. But when we got into the 1880s, 1890s, and they realized hygiene was a big issue of it, I mean, there's a reason why they tell you today that if you're in a war zone, you shower, you shave, you clean yourself up whenever you can, because they learned there are some lessons, and that, like I said, the impacts of this were great. And when you think about Minnesota, you know, people are off fighting in Europe, people are dying around you. It must have been surreal for the people back here to see something that was more reminiscent almost of the Black Death going on in town.
Yeah, one of the haunting stories in my book involved the Soderberg family, which is a large Swedish family up in the Moose Lake area. And they were all worried about David Soderberg, who was fighting with mustard gas in the trenches and the mud. And if you think about, I mean, all wars are kind of horrible. As a veteran, you could certainly relate to that. The Civil War was certainly no picnic. But I think when World War I, you introduce aircrafts dropping bombs, mustard gas, and horrible trench warfare. Anyway, this family's all worried about David off in Europe, and now the fires come sweeping across northeastern Minnesota. The parents put, I think it was 11 kids, in their root cellar out where they would keep their, you know, food stored for the winter, their ham and their potatoes, and figured they'd be safe there. As the fire came over, they threw buckets of water on the door to try to keep everybody safe, and then they hollered down the little ventilation tube to see if everybody was okay, and got no response. And after the fires burned through, they opened the door and found 11 people had suffocated as those fires sucked the oxygen right out. So a lot of people were worried about the horrors going on in Europe, but the horrors in Minnesota were arguably worse. When David Soderbergh returned, his whole family had been wiped out.
I mean, I've heard from people about the fire specifically. We can turn our attention to that now. It was surreal in the sense they just left bombed out buildings, bombed out towns, destruction in Europe, and came back to basically the same thing in areas of Minnesota. Why were the fires so bad that year?
Well, it was the driest year that Minnesota had experienced, the driest summer in 48 years. And the railroads played a fascinating chapter in the whole tragedy. And at the end, the government had taken over all the railroads because we were in wartime, so they'd kind of nationalized the railroads. And at the end of this saga, they looked back and investigated what caused the fire, and it was sparks from railroad trains that ignited that dry, brittle summer up in northeastern Minnesota. I mean, the trains were also heroic and saved thousands of lives with rescue trains pulling into towns and saving people, but they were ultimately pointed as the cause of the fire, and it was the first time ever that regular people took on the government and the railroads and sued and won, and it took 35 years until it all was made whole and the people of Minnesota were given the money they got for losing farms and lives and livestock.
Well, basically making sure the people who really were culpable were out of the way before they got the ruling, the justice on this. How many fires, I mean, specific fires were identified in 1918?
Well, it was a bunch of little fires that kind of turn into a big major fire. And if you go to Moose Lake, of course, they'll call it the Moose Lake Fire. If you go to Cloquet, they'll call it the Cloquet Fire. And they're very kind of, you know, they kind of localize things. But it really just turned into one big fire. And it could have been a lot worse. It got all the way to Duluth, to the fringes of Duluth, which, of course, was a thriving major kind of at its peak town in those days. And it made it all the way down to Lake Superior. But really, the typography in Duluth with the way the hills kind of wrap around Lake Superior kind of stopped the fire from being even worse.
One of the things that's interesting is you talk about the people and they're driving cars into lakes to basically, you know, save them. This idea of a wall of fire, that you saw a forest and where there was a forest is now just a wall of fire coming for you. There, a lot of these people that ended up dying in this catastrophe, there just was nowhere for them to go. And even in some cases in the lakes, that was just, if it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a big enough lake, you got killed that way because of oxygen getting sucked out or just it got too hot.
Yeah, and there's stories of survivors who would, like you say, gather in places like Moose Lake and throw wet blankets on each other to try to save each other. And witnesses saw the flames even jump across the lake and hit across the other side. So, you know, we get a few survivor stories, and I thought it was fascinating. A lot of the people affected by this fire, of course, were newly arrived immigrants from Scandinavia, and a lot of Finns up in that area were fighting the fires and, you know, doing the best they could.
I would say this, the one thing that comes after this is that we don't seem to have the fire issue that we had before after this time. Obviously, I think the legal attention, the spotlight being shown on the railroads and stuff, I think that obviously pushed them to kind of address their issues at that point. But I think we as well, that there came an idea that if we don't start dealing with these fires and knocking these down quickly, that we're going to end up losing major towns again.
Yeah, and I think that certainly the fire technology isn't what it was today. You know, that there were basically, you know, volunteers with buckets trying to put out this raging fire, and we've come a long way. But at the same time, out west, we've seen horrible fires the last few years in California sweeping through the west as well. You know, the railroads, they had some laws in place where they were supposed to put screens over the smokestacks to stop the cinders and sparks from coming out. But a lot of the conductors didn't like to use those because that would slow down your train and you couldn't be as efficient in getting stuff hauled around. And Minnesota at the time, too, it's worth pointing out, was really in a transition from a timber. They pretty much wiped out a lot of the timber up north. So we had gone from kind of a lumberjack economy up in that northeastern Minnesota and shifted it more towards mining and farming. So we were kind of at the end of the log boom that dominated kind of the early years, the 1880s and that kind of year. So by 1918, they'd kind of run through a lot of the timber, and and after these fires, they kind of shifted to more of a farm economy up there.
Well, and I can say this because my family was from the Iron Range. That changed the vegetation. I mean, you had these tall pines that were all taken down, and I've heard from people who said that, you know, once you changed that and you had, you know, more coniferous trees and they changed, you had much more ground. Like I said, you never used to have deer up there, but all of a sudden deer were everywhere because you changed the environment by cutting down all the trees, and that actually was a catalyst as well for these fires.
Yeah, and I mean, the amount of stories for me, the real challenge was kind of being a gatekeeper and what gets in and what gets out. And I mentioned the Finns before, and a lot of the stories were passed down. There was a Finnish guy named Edwin Manny who was a Finnish banker up there, so the Finns trusted him with their money and their stories. And in the 60s and 70s, he went around and recorded all these survivor stories and typed them up in kind of a hard-to-find book. Luckily, I got a copy of it. And some of these, he would meet people that he knew very well, but he said it wasn't until they would retire to the saunas that they would, you know, they didn't like talking about this stuff, but he got a lot of his information. A lot of these stories were passed down in the Finnish saunas of northeastern Minnesota.
Well, you and I could talk for an hour, easy. And by the way, I'm going to give you an open invite. I've given this open invite to about three or four people. Anytime you want to come on my show, I'll make time for you because this book is fascinating and it's always a treat to talk to someone who knows history and can enlighten us on the changes. The book is, I got a few things I'm going to mention here with you because you got a few appearances you're going to make here. Minnesota 1918, when flu, fire, and war ravaged the state. Kurt Brown, he's going to be, first of all, over at the Twin Cities Bungalow Club, St. Mary's Episcopal Church. This is going to be on August 22nd at 5 p.m. on Laurel Avenue in St. Paul, $5 for non-members. You have two events going on in Austin on Friday, August 23rd, a workshop at 10 a.m. and 1 p.m. a visit to Sweet Reads Bookstore. And then that's going to be on Saturday, August 24th. So you're obviously going to be going out there. I'll make sure I get all those events posted out there. And I'm presuming the book is available everywhere, right?
Yeah, they just decided to put out a paperback edition of the book. So if people haven't read it, and I should point out, it sounds like such a downer of a book, you know, the flu, the war, but it's really a story of resiliency and survivors. And there's a lot of uplifting stories about how people got through it and how they patched their lives back together and moved forward, which is kind of a classic Minnesota spirit. Comes through, I think. So it's not as depressing as it may sound.
Well, and it should be mentioned, change does not happen without tragedy. And
right.
We have to sometimes go into really bad cases to finally realize we need to make changes. And I think that 1918, that's why it was such a pivotal year. It was a bad year, but at the end of it, what came out of that was good.
Exactly. And people rallied together. And like I said, the resiliency of Minnesota has shown like never before.
Find Kurt's articles in the Star Tribune. I believe there's one on Sundays, right?
They're always on page B4 because history happened before. So that's right. And we've had 253 weeks, but who's counting consecutive weeks with a Minnesota history column? And like I said, I love doing it every week. So you can find those in the Star Tribune, and you can come see me when I'm giving these events.
Once again,
week.
Twin Cities Bungalow Club, 7 p.m., St. Mary's Episcopal Church. That's on August 22nd. Once again, I'll make sure I get a link to that. And $5 for non-members of the Twin Cities Bungalow Club to join that. But by all means, as you've heard here, Kurt Brown, I highly, highly recommend the book, Minnesota 1918. Kurt, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Thanks, Matt. I look forward to speaking with you again down the road.
Anytime, my friend, anytime. We'll take a break. Come on back. It is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. By the way, eatlocalminnesota.com, restaurant of the week, Burger Mo. Stop on by over in St. Paul on 7th Street. Get a great burger over there. Thank you very much to Doug Hoverson, also Kurt Brown. Fantastic books there. I'll put links to all their events that are coming up here. Make sure you go and enjoy it. Have a great weekend. We're off all next week. Great host filling in for us. We're back the following week. Have a great day. Till tomorrow. See ya.